Okay, thank you. I chose to give this formal presentation here and not the other one because I think it's, it covers many, many elements of mesoscopic physics, and I'm just 2 days here and I don't know the background of the people. But I understand there are people here from quantum computation also and other fields, so I thought that I'll give, well, I don't know if it's a tutorial talk, but something more basic that even people that do not know, you know, the jargons that we use in mesoscopic physics will be able to follow. And so please make this formal, informal, and ask questions. And because I'll try to go step by step through two experiments that we did, which are not necessarily earth-shaking with their results, but it will show you how we utilize all the armories that we have in mesoscopic systems, all the tools, all the one-dimensional and zero-dimensional and two-dimensional, to make this kind of, I would say, trivial in a way experiment, but that is quite illuminating. Okay, so I'll use this little gadget that I bought just last week. And I was very scared. I didn't bring with me. That's the first time I fly from Israel outside without a pack of plastics. So I hope it works. So the work, as usual, was done by students. And two of them, which are already left the Weizmann Institute, are Eyal Books and David Sprintzak. There's a pointer here, or I can use this one, I suppose. I can use this one if I know how to use it. It's more difficult, but these are the two students that did the work. And then you know that everything depends on crystal growth. So Vladimir Umansky and Ada Strickman grew the crystals, and Diana Mahalo did the nanofabrication, as you will see. And this work was greatly benefited from talk with our theoretical groups, mostly Gurvich, that in a way started thinking about these ideas in Weizmann initially, and then Joe Imri and Joshua Levinson, they did some calculations also. So what I will talk now, I will show you how we build an interferometer, and then indeed to show that this is a coherent device, and later on we will just kill its coherence, okay? But rather than doing it in a very sort of less controlled way by heating it or you know, applying a large voltages or doing something like this, we'll do it in a controlled fashion, okay? That's the whole idea. So first, just let's start from the very first sort of, I would call it seminal paper that was written by Stern, Aronov, and Imri in 89, that shows, and you will see here how I jump between these two ways, how to look on dephasing or decoherence. One way is to look on the electron itself that's supposed to interfere and see what happens to its phase. Okay, what happened to him? Okay, and we know that phase randomization of electrons can occur by multiple processes, let's say electron-electron, electron-phonon, spin flip, potential fluctuations, which are really photon absorption, etc. On the other hand, you can go ahead and look on the environment that does this to the electron, okay, and I'll call this path determination by the environment, by the detector, and see what information the environment provides, or the detector provides, and these are two totally mathematically equivalent ways, but sometimes when we look at it, as you will see here, it's not totally obvious that they are equivalent, but they are rigorously equivalent. Now, path determination, what I point out here, you might not even see that it's there, but even if it's a principle can be done, even there is no graduate student in the lab, and even if the apparatus is not fully constructed, it is sufficient. And I think these two examples that I'll show you will illuminate it quite nicely. So what we will do, we will employ a witch path detector, okay, to do this dephasing or control dephasing experiment. So first, if you just take quasi-particles, classical particles. We talked before with Charlie Kemp about quasi-particles, so it's a and let them move through two slits, then of course we know that we have some fraction of them going through one and fractions going to another one, and then we sum up both fractions and we get the distribution on some kind of a screen. Now, if we move now to indistinguishable quantum particles, then we get interference between amplitudes. This is a quantum effect because there is a probability amplitude that electrons will go through one slit to another. We sum the amplitudes and we absolute square the probability, the amplitudes that we get. Now, the experiment that I'm going to do is to take such an interferometer, which I'll show you how we build, and I'm going to add a detector. Okay, this is my environment. The whole environment is there, but I'm going to add another artificial environment, which is my detector, and I'm going to turn it on. And when it is going to recognize if electrons are moving to the left or to the right, the interference should go down. Yes?
Is it significant looking particles are going to be indistinguishable because the interference effect occurs even if you have different particles to go through one at a time, right?
No, but each particle interferes with itself. That's the only point I'm trying to say. You are. Otherwise, you have interference of particles A plus interference of particles B at C. Okay? You're right. But in this case, each particle interferes only with itself. So by using a detector, we are going to move from an interference pattern to a non-interference pattern. And then you can again look at it both ways. When the passes are fully distinguishable, the interference will disappear. Or when the detector interacts strongly with the path, the interference will disappear. So again, looking at the electron or looking at the detector. And then we move from T1 absolute up the sum of probabilities rather than the interference term I showed you before. So now let's now see how we do it. We now take, first of all, just write something up. So we have a detector. The detector looks now at the two paths. And assume now that the electron is going in path 1, then the detector is sitting in some chi1, because it senses that the electron is there. And if the electron is in path 2, then the quantum state of the detector is chi2. And if these two states are orthogonal, okay, then I have full information if the electrons went through or not. And if it's not fully orthogonal, then I have not full information, and the interference will not totally disappear, but it will be partial dephasing. Okay, so the orthogonality or not orthogonality of this will lead to dephasing. Now you can also look at it and say again the other way is that the electrons that are moving in the interferometer will feel, let's say, potential fluctuations from the detector, and this potential fluctuation will dephase the interferometer. So I will not do it every time looking both ways, but I just want initially to drive this point through, and I won't repeat it again later. Now, I saw that there are people that do also optics, and when we do experiment in the laboratory when we are younger, then we have a screen and we see interference on the screen. With electrons, it's more difficult to do because we don't have such a high-resolution screen. Okay, for electrons, because we have to put this many, many detectors on the screen with a separation of wavelengths or something of the electron. So we use sort of what I would say a type of a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, that we have one single collector and we change the phase of one path versus the other. Okay, rather than moving in space and changing the phase as we move in space, we look only at one single point. And now, how do we do it? How do we change the phase? We chose to do it, and there are not only one way, there are more than one way, by using the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So if we have two paths, and we thread a magnetic flux between the two paths, then we know that the phase added to one path relative to the other is the number of flux quantum times 2 pi. Okay, and this is a very powerful way that many of us are doing all the time. And in this case, we show only that the magnetic field is enclosed between the two paths. As you'll see in the experiment, the magnetic field is all over the plane. But since the path width is very, very narrow, it really doesn't matter, and the effect is the same. Okay, so now let me just give you an introduction of like 3 or 4 or 5 transparencies. What is a two-dimensional electron gas, etc. I can skip it if all of you know it. You do? You don't. Okay, so a two-dimensional electron gas, this is something that we live and thrive on. And discovered or invented, I would say, in 1978 or so. And this is sort of a way to get a very, very long mean-free path electrons. And we do it by combining two materials, or we create what the so-called heterojunction, one with a high band gap on the left and one with a low band gap on the right, and we dope the one on the left, okay? And we leave a little space between the doping, where it's within the donor level, so the electrons that are now falling from the left side to the right side are separated from the parent donors. Okay, now the idea is very simple, because now electrons are moving in a pure material. There is no any impurity scattering, and as a result, the mobility can be very high. So if you separate electrons from the donors, then you bend the bends because you have an electric field, and a potential well is created. And I made it triangle, and it's very near triangle, and then you have a confined state perpendicular. Okay, or in this direction. Okay, you have a confined state in this direction here, and electrons are moving into the blackboard freely, parallel to the interface. Okay, now just for some numbers, all these measurements are done at temperature well below 1 Kelvin. Okay, and the mean free path that we get today, that when this material, first of all, I didn't mention, but this is gallium arsenide. Okay, and this is aluminum gallium arsenide. And the material, gallium arsenide, can be grown very, very in a pure form. And the mean free path can be very, very long, many, many microns long. And here I have some numbers for Fermi energy, which is about 10 millielectron volt or so, carrier density per centimeter square, and the wavelengths of the electron is about 500 angstroms or so. So just to see the numbers that we are dealing in such systems. So the way you do it, you create, this is sort of a layer that you grow, layer of the gallium arsenide, you grow the aluminum gallium arsenide, you dope it, it's sort of layer by layer growth, and then you make microfabrication and you create this type of mesa, and current is running between ohmic contacts, and here you see the cut and the potential through the cut that I showed you before. Okay, so now how do you pattern it now? So now we have now a two-dimensional electron gas, so the whole plane, we have electrons in the plane, and now we want to make some, let's say, two-path interferometer, so we want to add another confinement in a new dimension, in the lateral dimension, and that you can do it by etching or put metal gates or whatever. So we use it usually by putting metallic gates on the surface, in exactly the same way that an FET is being built in the industry. So you have this, again, a cross-section of this two-dimensional electron gas, and a metallic gate is sitting at the top, and this is the two-dimensional electron gas shown in space. This is the conduction band, the Fermi energy, and all, let's say, temperature zero. This is a degenerate gas, and you apply now a negative voltage to the metal gate, and then you deplete the electrons underneath the metallic gate. And when you deplete the electrons, then you can deplete them a little bit. Okay, you raise the conduction band, and electrons that move from the left to the right lose velocity. Okay, the kinetic energy is here smaller than here. Or you can deplete them all together, and then electrons will have to turn back. Okay, so you create barriers. So the application that we will have here, that the barriers will be very, very high. There will be confining barriers, and electrons will be reflected from the barriers. So wherever you see a gate in the picture, you know that this is an insulating region underneath. Now, the way that how do you make now structures? You have this two-dimensional electron gas, and it's smaller than the mean free path, because you want all the electrons to move there with no scattering, if you can. And then you put a gate on the surface, and you create a depletion region underneath and also to the side. So when you change the gate voltage on the gate, you move the depletion away in the lateral dimension from the gate too. Okay, so this is sort of a way that you can, for example, create a one-dimensional wire in between, because you have a depletion region here and here, and electrons can flow only in between these two here. And we can also, by changing the voltage, change the width of this one-dimensional wire. Okay, so now we'll do this to build now an interferometer, okay, a two-pass interferometer in two-dimensional electron gas. So where you see here, this is a simple, everything that you see, a blue region, this is the negatively biased metallic gate, and electrons will be injected from the emitter at the bottom, and eventually be collected at the collector at the top, and we will thread it with a magnetic field that will cover the whole plane, basically, and create a path difference. This is sort of a schematic description of this, and create a path difference between the two paths. And then, hopefully, when we change the magnetic field, we expect to get interference between the paths that are going through the two slits, one path one and path two, and the phase and this will be the phase difference added by the magnetic field. So there will be some constant phase to each path, and the magnetic field itself, as I change it, will add a phase, and every phi knot enclosed in this rhombus-type area will have an oscillation. So I'll show you here a picture of actual results that I'll keep repeating it again. Okay. So now let's now start making the experiment itself. So first of all, when you look at it, you see that there is some difficulty in a simple realization, because electrons, if they move in the two paths, they're not localized. The electron is spread all over the path. So it might be a bit more difficult to detect the electron somehow if it is not localized. So what we want to do is we want to eliminate this problem. We have a weak detector path interaction by localizing the electron in, let's say, path number one. So if it chose to go through path number one, let him stay in this path in some localized region for some time and then continue on. So I have a chance to detect it. Okay. So how do we do it? We create some electronic puddle here. Okay. And now I'm going to spend a few minutes showing you what is this electronic puddle. So we create electrons will go, if the electron went through here, I want him to stay here for some time so I can detect it, okay, and then continue on. So how do I create now this electronic puddle? Okay, one more thing that I should say, as you see here on the bottom, when I create this electronic puddle here and the electron stays for some time here, it should still be coherent. Namely, it shouldn't stay too long here to interact with phonons or other electrons and lose its coherence, because I want it to be coherent from here to here. I just want him to stay for a little while on its way. Okay, so the way to do it, creating a localized electronic puddle, is to create a puddle, as you see here. And this is what we call a quantum dot. Okay. So this purple region are metallic gates, and there are a puddle of electrons sitting in the center of the puddle, and there are two tunnel barriers that the electron can tunnel in, stay in the puddle for a while, and tunnel out. Okay, and the two red regions on the side are two electron reservoirs that electrons are from there coming in and coming out. Now we can look at this puddle. First of all, look what happens to a small puddle. Classically, it has a small capacitance, and if it has a small capacitance, then it has a charging energy, because the capacitance is very, very small, so you need a large energy to charge the small capacitor with. So that's what we call charging energy, which is on the order of E squared over C. Okay, C is the capacitance and E is the charge of the electron. So you need to give some energy to put an electron into this classical puddle. And as a result, we call this puddle a quantum dot sitting in the Coulomb blockade regime. Namely, if you don't provide sufficient amount of energy, it is blockaded. Electrons cannot come in and go out. Now, if you add now the quantum effect, then it's a small island, confined small island, and which can be modeled by two barriers. These are the tunnel barrier, the input and the output. And then electrons will tunnel in, and then there will be here states which are quantized, because it's a small puddle on the size, on the order of the electron wavelengths. So now if you want to have current going through the device, or adding electron into the system, you have to overcome this, in this particular simple single particle level spacing, plus the charging energy, which I so that you don't see it here, but you see it here. If you want to add one more electron, you have to charge it. You have to add this classical energy plus the quantum level spacing. And I think that most of you heard about the quantum dot, and that's what I will be talking also tomorrow in the informal talk, showing you what kind of a phase is added to the electron when it goes through such a creature. Okay, so now how do we realize a quantum dot? This is a scanning electron micrograph picture, And let me just take it back. I want to point one thing only here. That you see, I added here a plunger. Now, this plunger, this is what we call plunger, is another metallic gate that allows me to take all this leather and move it up or down. So you can move it up or down by taking this bottom and pull it down electrostatically, or you can just narrow the well. Okay? In both cases, all these energy levels, leather will go up and down. So that we do by another gate, and the gate, most of the effects they do, that they really narrow down the metallic gate, the quantum dot, as you see here. You see this on the right side, there is this plunger gate, so the puddle is sitting in the middle, all these gray regions are metallic gates, and you will see the dimension in a minute, but the size here, you see that it's 1 micron bar, you see a 1 micron bar sitting at the top, so everything is quite small. And the dot and the puddle is sitting in the middle because there is depletion around all these metallic gates. And when I apply to the plunger gate a negative voltage, okay, I make the puddle smaller and smaller and squeeze electron out of the system. Okay. Now, again, these are some numbers, so you know which scales we are talking about. So the level spacing between levels, these single particle levels, is about 50 microelectron volts or so, because in a dot like this, you might have 100 to 200 electrons. And I told you that the Fermi energy is about 10 millielectron volt. So this is the average level spacing. And the temperature and the level width, okay, the level width, which depends how strongly the electrons are coupled to the dot outside, could be on the same order of magnitude. The temperature could be a little bit higher, or the level width can be higher. And this can be tuned by opening these two openings, the tunnel barriers. You can make the tunnel barrier opaque or more transparent and change the dwell time of the electron in the quantum dot, or the width of the level, if you want.
The level spacing is estimated on the basis of the size of the
quantum. That's all, yes. Yes, you estimate how many electrons there, you take the Fermi energy, divide it, and that's the number that I put there. Okay, so now, if you look now on experimental result, if you take this plunger and you start taking this leather and you move it down, when you apply a tiny voltage between source and drain, then you see that you have to overcome every time a charging energy. And when you overcome the charging energy, another electron is being added to the dot. And in the process of the fluctuation between n and n plus 1 electrons, there is current going through the device. So what we want to do is that we want sort of to tune the quantum dot to one of these peaks, and then assume that in this, somewhere in the middle of the peak or on the side, electrons come in, there is fluctuations of the electron number in the dot. But each electron there spends some time, which depends how well the dot is coupled to the outside. So this is my localized element, localizing element. That's what I showed here. The electron dwells here for a long time, relatively long time. I can make it very, very long if I close the dot a lot, if the dot is decoupled from the outside, but then the current will be very, very small. Okay, so it'll be very, very difficult to measure it. Now, the question is first of all, is this quantum dot coherent or not? That's the first question. Okay, I show you how I build a localizing element. I want to check if it's coherent, but this is trivial. I'm just going to put it inside my interferometer. Okay, so I have interferometer, and now I want to localize it, so I'll put the quantum dot inside one of the arms. Okay, this is the quantum dot. I'm going to stick it into let's say, path number 2, and then I'm going to check if I have an oscillatory behavior with magnetic field. If I have an oscillatory behavior, then I have at least a fraction of the current that is moving through, which is coherent. Okay? And the experimental realization looks like this. Now it looks a bit more frightening because there are many more gates there, okay? Many more metal pieces there. But I don't know how to turn it off. But if somebody knows, should tell me. Maybe it comes up. Okay, so I have this, you see this quantum dot in the center, and then we have this reflector gate at the top and at the bottom. This is only that the electrons that are coming from the right through the quantum dot, I'm sort of directing them to the collector, because if I won't put it in, then electrons would sort of roam all over the place, and the signal that I'll measure at the collector will be smaller. So this is just other features to increase the signal, but in principle, it's just what I showed you before. And I think after this comes up, I have to do this. Okay, so now this is the picture of the fully fabricated device, which is identical to what I showed you before. The only difference that is not showing there, you see this little island here. This is metal, and you want this to be an insulating region, because you want the electrons to go through here and here. So if this is an insulating region, you have to put some negative voltage here, right? So how do you put a negative voltage here? If you take a wire from here and cut it out, you will cut the path of the electrons. So you have to do something like this, right? You have to come up from the plane and go back down. So this is sort of tricks of the profession. So you see here this bridge that allows to put a voltage in, but at the same time, electron can sneak underneath without being affected by this voltage, okay? So this is now a system that we are going to check if this quantum dot is coherent. So I want to change the magnetic field, and I want to see if there is a two-pass interference with the correct periodicity. So here is the system. I look now on the collector current or something like this. I'm showing schematically how it looks there. So you have a lot of current coming from the reference arm. And on top of it, there is another current coming from the quantum dot, which I showed you in this region, the black that sits above this dotted line here. And then I'll check interference in these few regions here, in the black dot and then purple dot, etc. And I'll change the magnetic field and find if there is interference. And you see that there is very, very clear and nice interference here, okay? Suggesting that there is a reasonably large component of the current moving through this localized island, and it's still coherent, okay? Well, it's very difficult to say, okay, because here I look here on the total current, and here I look on the change. It's about 20% or so.
20% of the peak height that we see.
Is the oscillation strength, yes. Now, the existence of this oscillation suggests that there is, that the quantum dot is coherent. I'm not saying that it's fully coherent, that every electron that goes through never dephase, but there is a reasonably large fraction that is coherent. What I'm going to...
The fact that this is 20% doesn't mean that the 80% is incoherent.
No, it doesn't mean so. No.
Because in principle, you have the full coherency, but if the think about single electron interdependent, if the two arms are asymmetric,
exactly. You have several channels. Otherwise, I would say it's 20%. It's not. I don't know what is the fraction which is coherent. We believe that that most of the current is coherent. But the reason that you don't get 100% visibility is because of temperature smearing, passes which are not the same, multiple channel in the leads, etc., etc. Now, what I'm going to talk tomorrow is really, you see this green and red oscillation, and you see that they are not in phase, right? And I draw a line for you. You can see that as I move through this peak up and down, you see that the oscillation move in place to a different magnetic field every time, okay? So there is a phase change. So as I move up and down the peak, I keep adding phase in this arm. And by analyzing this change, I can find out what is the phase contributed by the quantum dot. And that's what I'll talk tomorrow, only about this part. Here I'm not going to talk about it because it's not of interest, but the results that we found by looking at this phase evolution, if you want, through a quantum dot in the Coulomb blockade regime and in the Condor regime are very, very surprising and very non-classical. But let me continue now with the subject of this talk.
Just to remind me, what is the setting for the quantum point contacts of the quantum dot here? They're all the same gate voltages there? I mean, for all four traces, when you fix the...
Oh, I change... Oh, which traces? These four traces? I change only the plunger. You see, there is this... I change the plunger gate voltage, and I move from this point to this point. There's no pointer here? Such high-tech stuff, no pointer? Okay. Here, I move from the black, it's okay, I manage like this, to here, by changing the plunger.
Yeah.
It affects probably a little bit also the openings electrostatically, but I don't touch them. Everything done, is this answering?
What is the transmittance of the point contacts?
Well, the quantum dot itself, you know, is open to a resistance of few tenths of less than 100 kilo ohm or so. So the transmission is, you know, you can estimate it that it's about to be 0.2 or something like this. Transmission per point contact. Okay, so now, so I'm just the green remark at the bottom here that the phase of the quantum dot can be measured, and that's what I'll talk tomorrow. But now I'm going now to move to the which pass detection. Okay, so now I'm going to take this interferometer which I showed you. So I took the interferometer, I localized the electrons in one path. Still, you should be nice, otherwise, yeah. Okay. And then I'm going to sense where the electron is by sensing the potential. Okay, what do I mean by this? When electron is being added to the dot, every time I add electron comes in and it went into the dot, and I'll show you it changes now the potential of the quantum dot. And this quantum dot is part. This is the quantum dot is part of the interferometer. So as the electron comes in, it will change the potential here, and with the detector I will sense this potential, and you can calculate, you know, the potential but we don't know exactly all the parameters. You have a mutual capacitance between here and here, and you have a total capacitance of the detector, and this is just a classical calculation which we don't calculate. We just measure it. Okay. So what is the behavior of the potential as a function of this plunger that you expect? This is a very simple picture, but I'll just go through it in 1 minute. So what you do is, you see this plunger, and when I change the voltage here, I have to overcome a charging energy. Electrons cannot come in if I don't overcome this charging energy. So I change the plunger, and the potential of the quantum dot changes. Let's say it becomes more positive, okay? And then an electron wants to come in, but it cannot because it needs a charging energy. So the potential of the quantum dot goes up. Okay, and then at some point I overcome the charging energy, an electron comes in the dot, but it doesn't come in zero voltage because there is some width to the level. So it comes in and it neutralizes the voltage on this plunger. It's in a simple classical capacitor. Every time you add the negative electrons here, an electron leaves the other lead. Here, you have to change the voltage a lot until another electron can come in because the capacitor is so tiny. That's all. So what you expect to get is that the potential will go up and go down, not in a non-symmetric way. This width here is the charging energy, and this width here is the width of the level. Okay. At the same time, if you look at the conductance, you will get a conductance like this. So this is the potential that we expect here, and this is the potential that we expect also in the detector, through the mutual capacitances.
Is the width of the peak, not the width of the level?
The width of the peak. Let's assume that the peak width, let's say temperature is now zero, and let's assume that temperature is zero, okay?
No, even so, the width of the peak is not necessarily the width of the level.
Okay, so this is at this point, why not? I mean, the width of the peak is the width of the level.
No, because if the width of the level is very small, much smaller than the level space in the dot, then you are right.
Yes.
If you start opening the dot.
No. Let's assume that the width of the level is much smaller than the level spacing in the dot. You are talking now, secret, at one higher level than the audience is interested in, I think. No? Okay. Okay, so now let's now look on two possible detection schemes that will use now these potential fluctuations. Okay, the potential, the sensing of the potential. The first detector that I will show you now is a detector that senses, I would say, a dissipating detector. So what I'm going to do is, suppose you have a detector with some kind of a potential barrier when there is no electron. This is the detector, and this is part of my interferometer near the detector. So initially, I don't have an electron here, and there is some potential barrier, and there is some transmission to a current that goes through. Now, when I add an electron to the dot, okay, I increase the potential barrier by this mutual capacitance, as you see, and then the current through the dot, rather than being large, a current through the detector goes down. Okay. Now, I'm stressing here that in this process, which is a quantum mechanical process, I will assume there is no change in phase. And you will understand later why I'm saying it. It's only that the magnitude of the current changes, but not the phase of the electron that is going through. Now, another way to detect is to have the detector is also an interferometer. Let me show you what I mean. If you have now, this is my interferometer, which I want to dephase, and my detector is also interferometer. So when I now add an electron here, this electron is already sitting here now, then let's say that the transmission here will not change, the current will not change, but I will add here some phase. Okay? So if I add here a phase, then the resistance from here to here will change, and I will also have dissipation. It's clear? So these are two different. So I will try now to construct one interferometer that will change the current as the electron is added to the dot, one that the phase will change, but the current will not.
Don't you go a bit too fast by calling it dissipation already?
No, I'm just saying, if you have a barrier and you have a voltage and the current changes, the V times I changes, that's all. In the contacts. In the contacts. If you have a point contact, and if you change the transmission of the point contact, the resistance changes, and you have dissipation in the contact. Of course, because it's ballistic, it has to be in the contact. Joshua Levinson wrote a very detailed paper on this some 8 years ago.
It's a subtle thing that you can keep talking on much longer.
Well, but okay, so first of all, we can argue where the dissipation takes place, but we agree with me that there is dissipation. There is voltage and there is current. And if you go to the electric company, you will pay the bill. Right?
Yeah,
the current changes.
But you can only define it if you define your environment, also in the context of whatever.
No, I have a detector.
I want to distract you by something.
If it's interesting, we can talk about it, but I say it's something very simple, that I have a resistor and I push constant current through the resistor, or I put constant voltage, and suddenly the resistance of the resistor changes. So I just have I square R, which is different, that's all.
Then I have an ohmic element.
You have?
An ohmic element, yeah.
Yes, the point contact is an ohmic element.
Right.
First of all, I didn't tell you what is the detector yet. Okay, it's going to be a point contact, but I didn't tell you what the detector yet. I'm just saying that you have somehow a resistor that changes, and now I'm going to tell you which one it is, but maybe we can talk about it more. Okay, so I have two types of detectors, and what I'm going to talk now, I'm going to start with the first one, and then I'm going to move to the second one. Okay, so the first one is exactly what I showed you before, that I change the transmission of a system because the electron is there or not. Okay, and the way that we do it, we use a quantum wire. Okay, so we have here, let's say, a wire, and then when the electron is there, the potential changes here, it makes the wire narrower, and I change the effective width and the effective resistance of this wire. And I think what Hans was talking about, that he is worried, where is the dissipation, okay? And if it's somewhere in, we'll talk about it, I'll show you the picture exactly, if it's in the contacts or where it is, because this is, everything is here will be ballistic, as you will see in a minute. But I change basically the transmission, and as a result, I change the resistance that I measure with an ammeter outside the system, okay? So now let's just construct this wire, okay? The wire again, so we went until now on two elements of mesoscopic system, a two-dimensional electron gas, and I jump to a zero dimension by talking about a quantum dot, and I'm going back to one dimension, which is the wire, which is a small constriction, okay? And then if you look now on the properties of this wire as a function of the constriction width, if you have this width, and you change now the constriction width, and this result came first from Hans' laboratory, and together with the people in Cambridge, that when you change the constriction width, then you find out that the conductance or the resistance is highly quantized. I mean, not very accurately, because there is always serious resistance. This is not the quantum Hall effect. But still, it's quantized very nicely with a quanta of 2e square over h, where the 2 stands for flux, for spin. Okay, and the reason for this, rather than you would expect in a classical resistor, when you change the width, to get here a straight line. Okay, and the reason for this, for these nice quantization steps, is because every time that I increase the width of the wire, Then I have here another mode or another channel that I can fit into the constriction. So every channel has its own contribution, and that's what I'm trying to show you here, that there is 1, 2, 3, and 4 modes, and as a result, I have 1, 2, 3, or 4 times E square over H. Now, we will work in the regime here, down here, okay? We will use it here as a variable, if you want, resistor here, and we will change here the transmission between 0 and 1. When there is a full transmission, then the conductance is 2 E square over H, and when it's pinched off, what we call pinched off, the transmission is 0, then the conductance is 0, and this is what's written here, and if it's in between, this T is between 0 and 1. Okay. So now if I put them together, this is my quantum dot, and this is my quantum point contact, and if I put them together, what do I expect? Here is my detector, and I can tune the width of the detector to be all here, right? This is the voltage that I apply here, which is effectively this W, the width of this opening here. So I can be all here, or here, or here, or here. And you can see that the sensitivity of my detector is different at every place. If I will be sitting at the plateau, then the detector will be very not sensitive, because if I change the potential, I will be moving on the plateau. So the transmission doesn't change. But if I will be sitting some point here and I will change the width, you see that the detector will be very, very sensitive. So the sensitivity of the detector depends on the width of the detector. So I can, with a knob, change the sensitivity of my detector. That's what I will do. Now, here, when I now construct it, so let's now make the experiment first. This is nothing to do with interference yet. We just make a quantum dot and we put a quantum point contact. This is detector sitting nearby the quantum dot, and let's see what is the behavior. So we have two separate circuits. First of all, this is the quantum dot. I change the plunger, that's the plunger here, VP, that's the plunger, and I squeeze, this is going, let's say, here into the negative direction. So I squeeze electrons out every time I change the voltage and I move in this direction. There is N, N minus 1, N minus 2, N minus 3, etc. The reason that the amplitude of the current goes down all the time, because when I change the voltage here, inadvertently, I also electrostatically affecting these two openings here. So I don't keep the openings here exactly with the same transmission all the time. This is part of our life in mesoscopic system. So when we change, make it more negative, in a way, we make the tunnel barrier seal higher and higher and higher. If you don't want to do it, you have to go back and open it and correct it every time. But I leave it here so you can see how beautiful the detector works here. So if you have now this conductance as the electrons come here, and you see what is now the transmission of this detector, how does it change? You see that it's very similar to the picture that I showed you before. Remember the sawtooth I showed you before? You charge it and it comes down, you charge it, it comes down. You can see very nicely here this picture of the sawtooth here. And this work was done also by other two groups before for other totally different purposes. We didn't invent this method. But you see that the detector is quite sensitive to the existence of an electron. When an electron is here, you see there is a nice sawtooth. And this delta T of the detector, this amount here, shows you the sensitivity of the detector. Moreover, you see that when there is no, you cannot even see current moving through the quantum dot anymore because it's already pinched off, electrons come in and come out all the time. But say the number of electrons here maybe is only 20 or 30 or 12, or we have other experiments that you go down to 3 electrons. So the current is very, very small, you cannot measure it, but if you would magnify it by a lot, and you have a very clean system and a system with no noise, you will see here little peaks, but you cannot see them. But the detector shows you that electrons are still moving in and out. This is sort of not so important for our experiment now. This is sort of an anecdote now that I want to show you.
So the detector measures whether an electron is there or not, and the current measures its ability to go through.
That's right.
They're not necessarily
the same. No. Okay, let's put it this way. The electron, when the current is very low, it means that the electron might stay in the dot for 1 hour. So you have every 1 hour, one electron. So the current is atoamperes. You cannot measure it. But here we measure a DC measurement. We wait for a very long time, and you can see that you can measure the potential of the electron there. But the current is the number of electrons per unit time, and this is very, very small.
What's the origin of the modulus?
Okay, so again, this is all garbage effect. Why does it come down? Because when you change the voltage here and make it more negative, I told you that it closes this, but it also closes this a little bit. So what happens here is that the transmission slowly comes down all the time. Okay? So if you want, when you do the actual experiment, every voltage that you change on gate A, you have to go in and correct at gate B and C, because all of them talk together because there are mutual capacitances between all the metallic gates. Okay, so now we realize it now. So it's very similar experiment to the one I showed you before. Remember, this is the interferometer. This is the quantum dot. Now, you are looking here for the plunger. In this particular case, this is the plunger. This island, the big one, is the plunger because we didn't have room to put the plunger here. And this one is the only thing that we added here is this little wire here. This is my detector that sits nearby. Okay, this is the quantum point contact. And they have two separate circuits. There is no tunneling from here to here. The only effect from here to here is electrostatically, like I showed you before. So there is one, this is the interferometer, emitter, collector, and a measure current of the interferometer. And that's a different circuit here for the detector itself. And you realize it, oops, sorry, too fast. This is the picture that is very similar to the picture I showed you before. The only additional part is this part here. So now before I'm going to show you now the results, I still have to talk a little bit about the detector and give you one more ingredient that we didn't discuss yet. Now, the detector, if it would be an ideal detector, what do I mean by ideal detector? No noise. Then the amount of this, the sensitivity would be irrelevant so much. I mean, it doesn't matter if this delta T, remember the size of the sawtooth, if it would be large or small, because it's large or small compared to what? We have to compare it, of course, to noise. And this system has intrinsic noise in it, and I want now to talk for about 2 or 3 minutes on the noise of the system. So first of all, there is shot noise in the system. This is the point contact detector has shot noise, and this is just because the electrons are discrete, okay? Discrete particles, and they stochastically move through it, and they create potential fluctuations and current fluctuations. And you can see right away that if now my detector is supposed to detect if the transmission is T or T plus delta T, it depends how much noise is there. If this noise will be bigger than this delta T, I have great difficulty to detect if the electron is there or not. Okay, so there is a competition between delta T and shot noise. Now, something about shot noise in the mesoscopic system. Okay, this is a pure quantum mechanical effect because there is sort of a stochastic, the electron stochastically goes through the barrier or not. Okay, goes through the quantum point contact or not. You will see it in a second. Suppose we start with a full Fermi C, a full Fermi C of electrons, no partitioning, no barrier at all. Okay, so a full Fermi C has, if you plot it in time, electrons move one after the other, and this is my experimentalist view of the picture, in a very ordered fashion, and they have no noise in the system at all, as you will see. If you have a full Fermi C propagating without any partitioning, there is no noise. If you now let this train of ordered particles, electrons, impinge on a quantum point contact with a transmission smaller than unity, okay, then you will get some transmission, average transmission, and you'll get partitioning. And this is sort of a stochastic event. Some electrons will go through, some of them will not go through, and the average number of electrons that will go through, the transmitted one, will be related to the impinging one by the transmission. This is the number that we talked before. Okay? And then we have noise in the system. And that's what we call partition noise or shot noise. And at the moment, we'll forget about temperature, because temperature will just add some it will have the 4 kTg, and it will modify this noise also. Okay? Now, if you derive this simple binomial distribution, you find out that the noise is proportional, the current fluctuation square is proportional to T times 1 minus T. And this was initially done by Lesovic or even Kluss before in 87 and 89 later on, that you can see right away when the transmission is zero, okay, if this is pinched off, there is no current, there is no noise. But when this is one, and this was at the time a surprise, when this is one, all the electron, all the C is going through, and there is no noise either. and the transmission is half, then the detector has a maximum noise. Okay, so this is something that our group was also dealt with it a few years ago and measured it, and these are experimental results from 1995. This is the point contact, and you look here on the, this is the plateaus of the quantum point contact, and this is the faint lines here are the noise at different applied voltages. Okay, and you can see that there is a peak here, and in the plateau there are minima. Okay, so this is now, I think, quite well understood. And by the way, this shot noise in mesoscopic system was used a few years ago to measure also the fractional charge in the quantum Hall regime, in the fractional quantum Hall regime. Okay, so this is a very, very powerful analysis tool. But I'm going here, the shot noise for me is a nuisance. The shot noise here is something that interferes with my detector to detect. Okay. So now if I now look on the induced dephasing rate, I'm putting now everything together, everything I told you until now, I'm putting now together. And then, first of all, it will be determined by the detector detectivity, namely how much will have this delta T, how much will it change, how much it will react to electron in the interferometer, and then how many electrons will be probing it, the impinging rate, the applied voltage on the detector. Then the other parameters will be the dwell time in the quantum dot. If the electron will stay in the quantum dot for a very, very long time, I'll have a chance to detect it, okay? And then it depends also on the noise. And if you put everything together and you derive this, then you find that the dephasing rate is proportional here. Okay, the dephasing rate, the higher the sensitivity, okay, the higher the sensitivity, the higher is the dephasing rate because the detector senses better. The same thing when the dwell time of the electron, this is one of the dwell time. When the electron stays for a long time, it will be dephased more. And you see here, and this is a bit surprising or not, depends on the point of view, the noise is sitting in the denominator here, and you can see here that the dephasing decreases when the noise is higher. Okay, when the current fluctuations are larger, if you look from the detector point of view, you say, oh, of course, the detector now has a large current fluctuation, it is blind. Okay, as a result, there is no dephasing. But if you look now on the opposite point of view, it's a bit confusing because you have large current fluctuations. At the same time, the electrons in the interferometer somehow doesn't sense it. So I'll come to this point a little bit later because this is a very confusing part. Okay, so now if I now put everything together, so I have this, just coming back to this formula, I just want to show you this formula one more time. It's delta T squared over T times 1 minus T. And this one I can measure, and this one I can measure, and if I now plot it, so I have, first of all, the sensitivity, which is delta T. Remember, it was in the plateau. The sensitivity was small. And when this is the T transmission. So in the middle, it was high. The noise also is high in the middle. And if you write now delta T square, if you write now delta T square over the noise, this term, you get a very non-characteristic shape that if we detect it, we detect it. It's not something monotonic, okay? So it goes, when you take this square divided by this, you get something that looks like this. So every time when the detector is a good detector, you have a large dephasing rate, and when the detector is poor, you have large, high interference. Okay, so I come now to the, after all this long introduction, I'm coming now to the result. So the way we measure it, we have our detector. This is zero, first plateau, and then I change the width of the detector by the gate voltage, and I move from here to here, etc. And I see what happened to the interference. So I'm standing here, and I measure the interference of my interferometer. And then I change my detector to the other point, and I measure again the interference. And then I plot the visibility as a function of the transmission through the detector, okay? And then I plot now the dephasing rate versus the transmission of the detector, and I find this is the detector, transmission 0, transmission 1. This is when there is no very small voltage applied at the detector, very small current going through it, probing. And this is when the current is larger. And then you see this double hump. This is plotted here, the visibility, which is just the opposite to what I showed you before. So you see, this was the double hump that I showed you before. And if you somehow try to fit it to this trivial formula, with only one fitting parameter, the dwell time in the dot, you get something which is quite similar. Okay? And if you now check the dephasing rate as a function of the impinging rate, the voltage that you apply to the detector, you get something that comes down. The higher the impinging rate, the more dephasing of the system. Okay, I want now to rush a little bit and go to the second scheme of detection, but before I just want to tell you what I told you before, that again, at this particular point here, you see what there are two, again, let's look again at two points of view. The first point of view is that when the noise is large, here in the middle, remember the noise was large, T equal half, the noise is large, detection certainty is small, and there is, as a result, large interference. But if you look now what happens to the electron, okay, dephasing due to scattering, when the noise is large, and if indeed large noise create large potential fluctuations, it's supposed also to have large dephasing. But this is not true, right? You saw before, and this particular approach is not correct. And this is very confusing. I don't know if you follow what I'm trying to say. You see, when the noise is large, current fluctuations are large. If you look from the point of view of the detector is blind. You can understand it. But if you go ahead and sit on the head of the electron, and you say there is large current fluctuations there, how come I'm not dephased? So somehow, you have to understand that large current fluctuations are not necessarily large potential fluctuations. And to me, personally, until now, I could not really decipher it exactly. I truly do not understand it. But let me move now very quickly in the next 5 to 10 minutes and show you now the other type of detector, which is what I did, not the dissipating, what I call the dissipating detector, but the interfering detector. So what I, if you remember, my detector now is rather than being here, a wire, a quantum wire, I put another interferometer. And what I'm doing is by adding an electron to my interferometer here, I'm designing in such a way that I'm adding a phase here. But I'm not changing the transmission here. How do I do it? You will see in 1 minute, okay? Now, the question, so this is what I was saying. I add a phase, and as a result, the resistance of this detector changes because I added some phase here. Now, the question which I'm asking, can this work if I somehow don't use an interferometer here? Let me tell you what I mean. Suppose I cut the top arm. Okay, I don't have a top arm. I just add the phase at the bottom part, but I don't have the top arm at all. Okay, and you can ask yourself, will this behave still as a dephasor? Okay. So what I'm saying here is written at the bottom, and I'll show you also in the next transparency. I'm having somehow a constant barrier somewhere, and I'm adding to the electron as it goes along the path a phase. But I'm not having any other arm to interfere it with. Okay, let me just stress this point one more time. Suppose I create something like this. You will see in a minute how I do it. I have an incoming beam, and I have it continues here and reflected here. And here I have my interferometer, and the electron here will add a phase here. But what I don't have, and I don't build in the laboratory at all, is this. I don't close the interferometer. I leave it open. Okay? So definitely there is no dissipation now. There is no change. There is some phase along the line here, but I don't take this and this and interfere it. I'll show you how I do. There is a change in potential. There is a change in potential that will change the path of the electron. You are asking why the electrons will not scatter back, why the transmission, and you will see. We are using edge states. I'll just in one transparency, you will see what I mean. Okay. So if now assume that this interferometer exists, and you calculate it now, and you see right away that the detectivity of this interferometer will depend now on the phase that you add, and the multiplication of the transmission amplitude from both sides, because the interference of this imaginary interferometer is this times this, and there is some sign of the phase here. So if this is going to work, then I'm going to get something that looks like this. These are the two amplitudes. You see this amplitude and this amplitude, the transmitted times the reflected. These are these two, okay, plus some sign of the phase. Okay, that's what I expect to get if this will work properly. And here I define the phase. The phase here will be the phase, the difference on phase between this one and this one without an electron, and the phase, the difference with an electron, okay? So usually I'm sort of asking people, what do they think if I'll have interference or not, but I don't have any time now to make a quiz. So I'll show you how do we realize it. So we realize it by applying a large magnetic field, and we are sitting in the quantum Hall regime. So we are sitting in the quantum Hall regime in filling factor one, let's say, okay? And then what happens is that all the current move chirally. There is no way it can reflect back. So you have now an edge state going here, and I didn't take now the time to explain quantum Hall effect and edge states because it'd be too long. But you can think about it skipping orbits because of magnetic field, and there is some reflection here. So some of the electrons going reflected back, some continue with the transmission like this, and there is some phase to this transmission. And now I put my interferometer here, and now when I put an electron in here, there is a potential change. It will deflect the path. I will add some phase, but electrons will not be reflected back because they have continued forward. So that's the trick. That's all. Okay. So now we change the phase, but we don't change the transmission. Okay. So now we expect now, as I showed you before, you see that now this term comes from the interference between the transmitted and reflected. But you see, this is the noise now. Same term as the noise. So now you see that the dephasing rate should be proportional to the noise, and not inversely proportional to the noise. All these things are not, intuitively, I wouldn't guess, okay? So now let's now continue and just tell you one more complication. If I want to work with a high magnetic field and edge states, my double pass interferometer quits. Doesn't work anymore. And why? Because now, before I showed you, electrons come from here, it can go here or here, and then interfere. But now when you have a huge magnetic field, all of them will go to the right or to the left, depends on magnetic field. So you have to be much more clever to create an interferometer, because an interferometer like this will not show you any Aaron of Bohm oscillations. Okay? So I have to build another interferometer, and the interferometer that we chose to do is not a double pass at all, but it's a quantum dot, it's a Fabry-Perot, which is not sensitive to magnetic field. 5 minutes, I'll finish in 5 minutes, yeah. Okay? Because I cannot spatially separate it, so if I have now Fabry-Perot, which is a quantum dot, electrons are bouncing between two barriers, and magnetic field does not really affect, okay, the behavior of this Fabry-Perot. So what we are detecting now, we are not detecting which path, right path or left path, but in a way, which trajectory. We are detecting more the long-lived trajectory in the Fabry-Perot versus the short-lived trajectories. But in principle, it's the same. Okay? So I'll go very quickly through it. So rather than looking on visibility of interference or so, we have a quantum dot, and we are looking how the width becomes wider and the height becomes lower. This is my now criteria for dephasing. And I should go quickly because there is a here issue of there is thermal broadening. So rather than using a one quantum dot, we use two quantum dots, because if you have one quantum dot, then the temperature in the leads widens the peak. But if you use two quantum dots, one after the other, then you really have only the width of the level itself, or twice the level itself. Okay, but don't worry about this. I don't want to dwell on it now. This is just a detail. And rather than looking on the peak, you see, because I have now two quantum dots. Let me just go. I'm sorry. Back one. I have two. I have one plunger and another plunger. So I'm now sitting in a two-dimensional space. And rather than looking on the width, I'm looking on the area of a peak. That's all. You don't have to know more than this. And this is the experiment that we look is looking on the area of this peak, okay, or the height of this peak, and check really if there is dephasing. And then what we find out, this is the way that we build it now. This is, you see, it's a totally different picture. This is a quantum point contact. The edge state is supposed to go like this here, transmitted here, reflected from here, continue here, and here I'm supposed to have this double path. But I replace the double pass interferometer with this Fabry-Perot interferometer, which is double dot. And now I'm changing here the transmission, and I want to check how the width of this peak, or the area of this peak, is affected by the transmission. Is it t times 1 minus t? Remember, this is it proportional to the noise? Okay, so what you find out that it is very proportional to it, and you see now this is without current going through the detector, and this is with current, and you see that you get this t times 1 minus t for the area, and you get the height is just the other way around. And I have just one more transparency that I'm going just to ask your opinion for it and sort of ask a question. Suppose now again, this is my detector, right? Electrons coming from here, part is reflected, part is transmitted. So what I showed you until now, that you really don't have to interfere them both. It happens. Nature somehow knows to interfuse these two things and get the information out. So, but suppose now I do this. This is now the experiment I showed you until now, right? Injected edge state, continuing here, interaction region here, reflected part. What will happen now if I add now here another source? If I add now here one more source that will continue here, part of it will be reflected, part of it continue. So this phase that will be added here will be for this edge in the transmitted line and for this edge in the reflected line. So what I did now, I call it too much information. I have now like a Mach Zehnder that rather than putting from the X side, you put also from the X and also from the Y, if you know what I mean. What do you think will happen? Will this create dephasing or not? But it might be late in the day and after an hour talk, so it's you have an excuse not to. Okay, so I won't torture you. There are two ways to look at it. If you look at Mach Zehnder interferometer and you have two inputs, then you see the interference vanishes. Okay, and you can show it very clearly that when you have the same phase coming here in the reflected part and in the transmitted part, and you now try to interfere this part and this part, you will see that there is no interference at all. So my detector does not know if the phase had been added or not, because in one it comes in the reflected part in one and the transmitted one you won't see. The other way to look at it is forget about the detector. Let's see what the detector does to the electrons, to the interferometer. Okay, that's the second line here. Will I have shot noise here in the system? Okay, this is very easy to look because the shot noise is the part that dephases it. So since these are fermions, I cannot have shot noise here. Let me go through it. Suppose an electron comes here, and let's say the transmission is half. The electron has a probability half to go here and half to go here. But if I have another full Fermi sea of electron coming from here, then if this electron chose to go here, then this electron will go here. Right? And if this guy, the light blue, chose to go here, then the dark blue one will choose to go here.
Source one and source two are the same.
Same voltages. Exactly. Sorry. Very important. This and this are the same voltages exactly. So there is no way that you will get any shot noise here. So if you want to understand it from this point of view, this fluctuation, there is no fluctuation. So. And this is very easily can be. So I have now twice as much as current, but there's no dephasing at all. So here are just the result. That's what I wrote here, fermionic statistics. And you see now, when I have only one source, 1 millivolt, I have this T1 minus T. The second one I have, but when I have both of them equal, it's a mistake. It's 1 millivolt here, not zero. There is no noise, and there is no dephasing. Okay, so I think that I'll just stop here. I'm sorry that I took a bit more of the time. Thank you. You scare people so much. Hard, urgent.
Right. To also say that Monty is here for two more days, and in this corridor, I'm trying to unload all your anxieties about him. This is really what you have realized, the two electron or two fermion interference experiment. Is this the first, or will they?
No, I think this is, people tend to call this sort of like a Henry-Brown twist. These are trivial things. It's not interference of two electrons. This is, you have two full, you can have all kind of fancy words and call it, you have two full Fermi's coming one against the other, and that's all. And so there is no way that current can go here or here. I don't know if it's...
I think
you talk about the previous transparency?
The last one was more than Handley granted, so we call it two photon interference in quantum optics, which was first seen in 87, where if you have two bosons, identical bosons coming in, they have to go...
No, but this is... No, okay. No, I'll tell you why... No, it's not, because I would be much more excited if it would be. Because bosons have... You're looking at exactly at what I call exchange statistics, right? Because each boson, you can have tons of bosons going here and here. This one is not the exchange of fermion, but this is exclusion statistics. Namely, there is no room in the Fermi sea to go. No big deal. There is no any new physics here. If you have a full Fermi sea coming in, so you can look at it, yes, one fermion wants to go here and one here, but you can say, well, the whole Fermi sea is full, there's no place to go. I can make it very simple. When you understand it, it's not exciting.
Let us send the speaker again.